spit out the shells into a plastic cup. And I would just chew those seeds until my cheek turned raw or started cramping up or something. And then I would take that cup, realizing it was kind of gross, and, you know, knock all the shells out. And then I would take it to the sink and fill it up with water and then set it next to the sink so that it could soak, so that when it went through the dishwasher, it would be nice and clean for the next person who would drink out of my spit cup. Now, since then, I've realized that's still pretty gross, and I probably should have used a disposable cup, but that idea never occurred to me. So one day, we had a young lady living with us, and she was engaged in a conversation with my wife, and she got thirsty in the conversation and went and grabbed her cup of water and took a big swig of it and suddenly realized that this was not the crystal clear, fresh spring water that she was expecting. Instead, it was spit cup water that was kind of salty and had little chunks of sunflower seeds in it. Okay, the point here is it doesn't matter how sincerely she believed that that was her cup of water. She was wrong. And her faith, no matter how sincere it was misplaced. So you may be sincere about what you believe, but you may be sincerely wrong. So the question when we think about different religions is, which religion teaches truths on which we should place our faith? And maybe there's not going to be a huge difference between, let's say, Baptist and non-denominational or something, but there are huge differences. And as Todd talked about last night, I don't think we should be ashamed of believing that our religion is true, because everyone believes what they believe because they think they're right. Everybody does. And so there's really no shame in that. We just want to make sure that we're as right as we're confident that we are. Some religions contain a lot less truth than others. So we should be able to acknowledge not every religion is true. Let me give you a few examples. The Prince Philip movement. Prince Philip is what people in America would call the King of England. And on the Pacific island of Tana, he showed up one day, and they're like, whoa, you're like the white man God that was supposed to come visit us that our prophecies talked about. And so it's kind of like an episode of Gilligan's Island, if you've ever seen that before. And so they started worshiping him. The Nubian Nation is an American religious group that believes that white people were created as a slave army to serve blacks. Saturn is not really a planet, and the Quran is a product of Jewish and Catholic collaboration. The Cosmic People of Light Powers, also called the Universe People, believe that UFOs orbit the Earth and will someday guide followers into another dimension. The Flying Spaghetti Monster religion has one belief, and that dogma, or that thing that they need to obey, is basically just the belief that there are no rules, there are no dogmas. And so we can see that these religions might be poor examples of religions in which we should place our faith, right? We want to believe something that's true, and these ones are a little bit suspicious. My clicker seems to be dying. So, what is the object of our faith? That is critically important. John 14:6, Jesus answered, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus said that he is the way and he is the truth. So Jesus is a great object of our faith. We can believe a lot of different things. The sincerity of our faith is inconsequential compared to the object of our faith, which is Jesus.
You guys hear me okay? Yeah, all right. I'll assume you can hear me. Good morning. It's great to see you guys. My name is Trevor Van Schooneveld. You may not have met me. I am from Omaha. I brought the obligatory family picture. That's my wife, Danelle, is here. Our three daughters, Kara, Bethany, and Abby, are here, but our two sons are having fun with Grandma and Grandpa and their cousins. I am a pastor out in Omaha. I'm a bivocational pastor out there. My other job is as an infectious disease physician at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. So what does an infectious disease physician do, you might ask? Well, If you've heard of coronavirus and Ebola and flesh-eating bacteria, those are the things that get me up in the morning. Except for maybe coronavirus has just been a real drag for the last 18 months. I'm really excited to talk to you guys today. I'm very excited. It's been really good to go through Jesus and the exclusivity and inclusivity of Jesus and the Bible and that God exists. And we sort of laid a foundation for Christianity, that Christianity makes sense. Today we're going to talk about Christian doctrines and Christian ideas in the Bible. We're going to address some worldly philosophies. And I love this verse that was shared on the, I think it was shared on the first night from Colossians 2. And you guys, if you read the reading today, you read it. This is what Paul wrote. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elementary spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. So Paul was warning the church in Colossians, don't get swayed by earthly philosophy. That's kind of what we're going to do today. We're going to help you, hopefully, to not be swayed by earthly philosophies. I'm going to talk about evolution, which has been an earthly philosophy that has existed for, 150 plus years. Steve is going to talk about transgenderism, and Josh is going to talk about racism. These are worldly philosophies. And one thing you should know about these worldly philosophies is they are empty. They are useless. They are not worthwhile. Where do they come from? They come from human traditions, and they come from demons. Okay? That's where these worldly philosophies come from. That's why they don't work. That's why they're disastrous to your lives if you embrace them. So I'm going to talk about evolution. Now, let me get back. Sorry, that was my revised intro. If you go to school, you will learn evolution. I mean, if you go to a Christian school, maybe not. But every secular high school and college biology class will teach you evolution as a required part of the curriculum. Nothing else can be taught, so say the courts, because the courts have already decided that evolution is all you can teach. This is a famous event from, maybe not so famous to you, from 2014. This was a debate between Ken Ham, who is the one of the founders of Answers in Genesis, which is they built the Creation Museum, they built the Ark Encounter. If you ever get a chance to go visit those, I would strongly encourage you to visit them. They are super cool. He debated Bill Nye, the science guy, creation versus evolution. Now, Bill Nye, not actually a scientist, an actor, but he does know a lot of science, and so he is an intelligent guy. Now, they had a debate, and whatever you think of the outcome of the debate, the evolutionists considered it a loss before it even happened. Now, why did they consider it a loss? Not a loss for creation, but a loss for evolution before it happened. Because evolutionists think we are done with debate. Evolution is proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, and their stance for the last probably 5 to 10 years is we do not even engage in debate with creationists. It is decided, it is done. If you believe in creation, you'll hear a quote later, you're an idiot, you're a moron, or you're evil. Okay? So, is evolution the answer? Is it done? Am I now going to get down? Well, Josh is really hoping that I'm not going to. I'll tell you my opinion. I'll give you the sort of the conclusion at the beginning. Okay? I think evolution is a zombie. Is a zombie alive or is a zombie dead? A zombie is dead. Okay? By the end of this, hopefully you'll see evolution as a scientific theory is dead. But now, is a zombie dangerous? Yes. A zombie will catch you and eat your brains, right? So is evolution dangerous? Yes. Are there still lots of, well, there aren't zombies right now, but in every zombie movie you watch, is there like one zombie or lots? There's always lots. Evolution is everywhere. Okay? So we're going to go through this, and hopefully by the end you'll see evolution this way. Before we start to talk about evolution, I want to talk a little bit about philosophy. You guys have probably seen signs like these or flags like these. They have a bunch of philosophical statements on them. And one of them is usually that science is real or science is science. And so that's not a statement that I think, you know, the studies on how we treat coronavirus are accurate or inaccurate. That's actually a philosophical statement. It's a statement espousing materialism. You might say, well, what is materialism? Well, materialism is not just I want to get a bunch of stuff. I mean, that is materialism. But a materialistic philosophy is a belief that matter is the fundamental substance of the universe and all things can be explained by material interactions. We talked about this yesterday, right? It's this deterministic philosophy that everything is chemicals and electrical impulses and natural laws and genes, and nothing that I do has any meaning. It's all just stuff happening that's already predetermined. Now, another philosophy very closely related to materialism, somewhat derivative, is scientism. And scientism is the belief that only the hard sciences, chemistry, biology, physics, astronomy, those things where you can measure outcomes, they're the only source of knowledge. You can see how this fits into materialism. That's the belief of scientism, and that other sciences are not as good. Philosophy, we talked about yesterday, that's not useful. It's not. That is the belief of scientism. And that is a strongly held belief these days amongst many people. Now, the other thing that scientism would say is that because if we can't measure it, it doesn't have truth or meaning, that means all sort of morals, ethics, all of that is sort of gone. And so the implications of scientism, I mean, it makes sense to say, well, I want to believe what could be measured, right? That's appealing. I'm objective. I want to be rational. The implications of scientism, right, only what can be tested is true would be the mantra, is that all religions and ethics are based on blind faith, not on truth or reality, right? Because only truth we can know are things we can measure, numbers, forces, things like that. And so religion is not factual. It's totally subjective. There's no truth. Everyone can have their own truth. And the good news about that is you can do whatever you want, right? If there's no morality, there's no truth in that, you can do whatever you want. And actually, if you read a lot of evolutionists, that is, they like evolution because it allows them to do what they want. The second thing about scientism, it actually changes our view of tolerance. So classically, the view that I grew up understanding what tolerance meant was that there are certain moral views. Some are right, some are wrong, some are more right than others, and we can discuss them, and we listen to other person, and they espouse their views, and I espouse mine, and we have a talk about them. Somebody's right and somebody's wrong, but we're respectful in our discussion. The modern view of tolerance, which you guys have all probably experienced, and this comes directly out of scientism, is that in these areas where we can't measure, we should never even judge. We have no right to judge that there's any right or wrong. And if you say there is an objective right or wrong, you are intolerant and bigoted. In scientism, there is no truth, and so disagreement is both pointless and immoral. The problem with scientism, though, is it's like some of the other philosophies we talked about. It's self-refuting, okay? To say only what can be tested is true is not a measurable scientific statement. I can't go out and run an experiment to prove that. Okay? That is a philosophical statement. So you're making a philosophical statement that only what can be measured is true, and your philosophical statement can't be measured, and so it must not be true. Okay? So, scientism, like those other philosophies we talked about, is an empty, useless, void philosophy, but it is prevalent, and you can see these outworkings in our society today. And so we clearly don't want to go in for self-refuting philosophies. I hope you guys aren't thinking, boy, that sounds really good. I'll believe in something that refutes itself. So what do we do as Christians with science? I think this is an important question. As a scientist, I think it's a really important question because I've seen more Christians rejecting science. They're saying, well, there's some science is bad, and I won't believe any of it. The great thing about being a Christian is science integrates with the Bible. Good science fits with what the Bible says. Science does not refute the Bible. That is fake news, okay? You hear that, science refutes the Bible. Not true, whether it's archaeological science, biological science, astronomical, it all fits with what the Bible says. And for the last thousands of years, we've had many scientists who are Christians. And if you may not know this, but actually, all of science is founded on our ability to understand the order of the universe. And if the universe was orderless and meaningless and came to be out of, a bunch of luckiness, why would there be order? Okay? So scientists for many years, some famous guys you may have heard of were Christians. Guys like Newton and Faraday and Kelvin and Joule and Boyle and Linnaeus and Mendel and Pasteur, Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Pascal. These guys were all amazing scientists who believed that God created the universe. And because he created the universe, there's order. I can discover because God is a God of order. So I hope that we have more Christians who become scientists so that we can sort the anti-God philosophy out of science, because that's what we need. There is a lot of anti-God philosophy in science. All right, let's see. Where's my next slide? Oh, okay. This is another important point, is about the data. When you read about evolution, you're like, oh, there's so much evidence for evolution, and there's like nothing for creation. Now, what you need to know about science is data is just data, right? Rocks do not come out of the ground with a date. Fossils do not come out saying, oh, I evolved from this into this into this. Genes do not say, I started here, and then this gene turned into this, and this gene turned into this, and that's how we got there. People bring that interpretation to the data. And so we don't have big piles of data weighing one way or that. Well, I think we do, actually, but not the way that people think. What we have is a bunch of data. And how you interpret, how you put that data into your schema is going to depend on the glasses you put on. If you put on your evolutionist, materialist, scientism glasses, which rejects all supernatural and sees only natural processes, that's all you're going to see. But if you open your eyes just a little bit, you're going to see there's something more than natural processes going on here. All right, let's see. Where am I at? Really important you understand this. All data does not favor evolution. Now, there are some things that might go more, a little more towards evolution, and there are some things that definitely go more towards creation, and I'll give you a bunch of data at the end and let you make your decision. All right, so I wanted to talk all about the history of how we got to where we're at, but we just don't have time. It's a really interesting topic if you're interested of how we got there. What I'll tell you is the men who developed the ideas that Darwinism is founded on were philosophically committed to developing explanations for the universe that excluded God. And the first of those was old earth geology, which showed up in the early 1800s. And actually, Charles Darwin brought an old earth geology book on his voyage on the Beagle, right? He took this long voyage all around. It was like 5 years long. He went all over the world. And Darwin was a naturalist. And he made a lot of observations about animals and plants, and he saw that some animals are larger and some are smaller and some are darker and some are lighter and some have bigger beaks and some have smaller beaks. And they had these adaptations. And what he reasoned is that, you know, if you have a certain adaptation in an environment, you might survive better because there's not an unlimited supply of food. And those organisms that have adaptations that fit them better for that environment are going to reproduce more and become the dominant species. And that was the idea of natural selection. It was a good observation. But what he did was he took natural selection. He said, if I can see that happening on a small scale over a short period of time, if I add into that millions and billions of years, I now have an explanation for everything that exists. We all came from a common progenitor. And so Darwin's theory of evolution is basically time plus natural selection starts from something. We don't want to really get specific about what that something is. And you get all of that. You get everything from one something. Okay? And the magic ingredient is time and natural selection. Okay? No purpose, no creator. And it really scratched the itch of the academics back then because they were really looking for a way to get rid of this idea that God created. And this is what Richard Dawkins says. He's a famous promoter of evolution. He says, in speaking of Darwin, he says, although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, he made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. We now have a way to say the universe came into existence that doesn't involve God. Great. And it, through an interesting set of circumstances, became the dominant theory for the origin of the universe. And Darwinism has permeated all aspects of our society, not just science, but the soft sciences, psychology, sociology. I mean, you go watch PBS morning cartoons, you will hear Darwinism. Dinosaur Train, has anybody watched Dinosaur Train? I banned that from my kids watching it because it promotes millions of years, right? It's training our kids. We are inundating people with Darwinism from young age to old, right? And it's become so widely held that, like I mentioned, the scientists don't even want to debate it. And they view people who don't believe in it very negatively. This is what Mr. Dawkins says. It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. And so I think Mr. Dawkins would probably consider me wicked because not only do I not believe in evolution, I believe in Jesus and I'm religious, right? Which he considers a great evil. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. Now, this is the world that I went to college in. I went to Colorado State. I majored in biochemistry. I remember learning about Darwinism back in my molecular biology class, and they had the typical pictures that they show and the same arguments, and I don't remember necessarily doubting God because I was a Christian already by the time I heard those arguments, and I heard a little bit about creation, but it was hard for me to like put the science together with what the Bible said. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of stuff about evolution here, and we talked a lot about it. And it wasn't until actually I finished college that I started to really look into this and say, boy, how do I reconcile like all this science and evolution with what the Bible says? And so I read a lot of books. And I'll tell you, I actually went through a variety of different positions of where I stood on this topic. And I'll tell you now, just to tell you my position, and I know there are a variety of positions out there, is that I believe that what the Bible says is literally what happened. God created the earth in 7 days, some thousands of years ago. Soon after that, it was destroyed by a worldwide flood. Now, we should talk briefly about the positions people hold, because there are a variety of positions, and it could be a little confusing. And so, there is the materialist-naturalist position. A lot of these positions relate to how do we view Genesis 1 through 12, which is creation and the flood. And those are sort of the key events that evolution attacks. And so a naturalist or a scientist would say nothing supernatural, there was a big bang, there was evolution, there was no interventions, the first 12 chapters of Genesis, that's just myth, okay? It's a nice story, but it just didn't happen. The next option is there are a lot of people out there say it doesn't matter or I don't know. And I think it's okay to say that. The only problem is the world does not have that opinion. The world says it matters and we know and you just be quiet if you don't know. And we're not interested in what you have to say. And so I think it's good to have, and this is just an opinion, this is not from the Bible. It's good to have a position on this. Okay? Because the world has a position, and if you don't have one, the world's going to try to move you to its position. Next are young earth creationists. They would say Genesis 1 through 12 is exactly what happened. One thing about young earth creationists is while they believe in the supernatural, they do not reject natural processes. We don't reject science. I think there's never been a better time to be a young earth creationist. Next, there are intelligent design advocates, and I love these guys and the books they write. They are a bit of a mixed bag in what they actually believe about Genesis. What the idea of intelligent design is, things look like they're designed. If there's design present, there must be a designer. If I walked up and saw this building, I wouldn't say, wow, it's amazing how like the rocks and sticks all came together to form a building, right? I'd say, boy, somebody must have designed this building. It has purpose. And so that's their argument. Because we see purpose both on a microscopic level, and yesterday we talked about how there's the fine-tuning of the universe, because we see those things, there must be a designer. Now, they don't get in to who the designer was in their arguments. They try to stick mostly to the scientific arguments and avoid the sort of theological baggage. At least that's my interpretation. If you ask these guys, most of them would say, I believe God created it. But they don't get into it into their books as much. And they like to avoid talking about it in their books. But most of them would say, yeah, God created it, some sort of, and a lot of them, there are Catholics in there, some of them are young earth creationists, some of them are old earth guys. There's a variety in there. But they're fantastic, the stuff that they write. There are progressive creationists, people who think that the earth is old and that God progressively created. They say, evolution can't explain it. God's going to progressively create at different times. It's a way of sort of integrating old earth with creation. And then finally, there are Christian evolutionists. And these are people who say, well, God created it. He started with a big bang. Boom, it all happened. And then he used evolution to create that. And when you read literature, you'll find these different beliefs in some of the, in the books. Now, what I want to do next is I want to talk about some of the implications of evolution to our faith. And so, Christian evolutionists, there are some things you lose when you lose Genesis 1 through 12. And so I don't want to be critical of people. And you have to, so it took me probably 10 to 15 years to work through my belief. And so if you're not sure where you stand, you should work through this. And you should read on it, and you should study it, and you should figure out what it is. But if we accept evolution, I just want to lay out some of the things that we will have to give up if we accept evolution. Okay, the first thing is you cannot read Genesis 1 through 12 literally. Right, that's where evolution, Old Earth geology, those ideas are there because they want to get rid of Genesis 1 through 12. Genesis 1 through 12, if you accept evolution, can't be literal, okay? Because that would be days, and evolution says it's not days, okay? Second, it wasn't 7 days, right? Third, Adam and Eve did not exist. If you accept evolution, Adam and Eve could not have existed, right? The evolutionary theory says we came from 30 to 40 hominids who arose in Africa some million years ago, unless you think that's racist, and then there are 3 separate groups of hominids that grew up in different parts of the world. I'm not going to go into the racism built into evolution, but there's a lot of racism built into evolution. Fourth, there's no worldwide flood, right? That was the foundation of Old Earth geology, is we need to get rid of the flood. The flood did not happen. Uniformitarianism, what we see is what's been happening for many years. There was no catastrophic flood. And then I think this is the one that really has always gotten me, is that if I am going to accept evolution, I have to, as a Christian, I have to say that we never really understood Genesis for like 3,000 years. Until some men who rejected God, who were specifically looking for ways to explain away God, said, well, this is what God really meant when he said this, okay? That's the one that's always gotten me. How could men who didn't believe in God suddenly explain how God created? It just does not compute. And so these are some of the things you have to give up, but there's more than that if you believe in evolution. There's some really foundational things for our faith that I want to talk about. One of the things about accepting evolution does is it impacts our view of people. You know, our view of humans is founded in what God says about us. And this is what he says in Genesis. He says, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven and over the livestock and over the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created a male and female. He created them. The Bible clearly says God created men. He created male and he created female. Steve's going to talk more about that in his talk. But he created humans different and special than any other thing he created. He created them in his image. You might say, well, that's nice. Well, that is nice. But that's also the foundation of why we might eat a steak from a cow, but we're not going to eat a steak from a person, right? It's kind of silly, but in evolution, why do we have the differentiation? Right? This passage is the foundation of why we don't kill people, because we are made in God's image. So it's why we don't believe in abortion, why we don't believe in euthanasia, and why we don't believe in murder, right? This is the foundation. People are special, unique creations by God created in his image. If you're an evolutionist, a man, an animal, a plant, an algae, they're all kind of just the same things. They really don't have any different value. And so to kill people in the womb, kill people because they're useless, kill people because they don't offer much to society, in evolution terms, that's okay. You saw that in the outworkings of the Nazis, right? Why did they get rid of the inferior people? It was an evolutionary idea. So evolution shatters our view of men and women in the image of God and the value of man. Second, it impacts our view of marriage and gender. Steve is going to say a lot more about gender, but God created male and female. He didn't create a bunch of different genders. He created male and female. And that's the foundation. Genesis is, again, the foundation of that belief. Next, marriage. Where does the idea of marriage come from? Well, it turns out God invented marriage too, right? God took Adam and Eve and brought them together as the first couple in a covenant relationship between man and woman for life. And in that, he established the boundaries for sexual activity, and he created marriage. And this statement in Genesis is so foundational. Do you guys know who said this? Who said this in Matthew? Jesus said this. Jesus was being asked by the Pharisees about divorce. He said, oh, Moses let us write these certificates of divorce. And so Jesus, he doesn't go back to Moses. He goes back to Genesis. And it says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, shall hold fast to his wife, and the two should become one flesh. So no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let man not separate. Okay? Jesus used Genesis as his reference to understand marriage. But if we accept evolution, marriage is no longer created by God. Marriage is a social creation by man, right? Men created marriage, and so marriage can be between a man and a woman, but it can be between a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. But why stop there if it's a creation by men? Why not a man and six women? Why not a man and a horse? Okay? It seems silly, but if marriage is a social construct created by people, there's no reason not to do that. Okay? That's, again, why Genesis is so foundational. This is where the belief in marriage comes from. Next, it impacts our view on the reliability of New Testament and Jesus. Okay, Jesus referenced Genesis when he was talking about marriage. Paul referenced Genesis when he was talking about marriage. Peter referenced a worldwide flood that destroyed the earth. If those events did not occur, then Jesus, Paul, and Peter were mistaken about history and about what God had done in the past. And if they're mistaken, we're in big trouble as Christians, okay? And then the last thing it impacts is it impacts our view on sin and our need for salvation. If Genesis is fake news, then where did sin come from? And why did Jesus have to come to die? Genesis 3 very clearly describes where sin came from. Man's fall and his consequence, that Adam chose to disobey God. And we all suffer. This is what Romans 5 says. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because of all sin. Because everyone here came from Adam and Eve. Everyone here. We all suffer the consequences of Adam's sin, right? Which is spiritual and physical death. Adam passed on sin and death to us. So it changes our view of sin, but it also changes our view of salvation. If sin didn't happen the way it happened in Genesis, where did sin come from? And then why did Jesus have to come? If there wasn't any Adam, how are we all, we're not all maybe descended from Adam. We're all descended, did the other hominids sin too? Or what happened there? So the good news is God created a plan for salvation through one man also, right? And in Romans, it ties together Adam and Jesus as representatives. Therefore, as one trespass led to the condemnation for all men, so one act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all men. For as by the one man's disobedience and many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience and many will be made righteous. Because of Adam's sin, we all suffer. We all trespass. We all sin. We are all condemned to die. But God's plan for salvation was to send Jesus, the one man who would live a righteous life, and would die on the cross and offer salvation to us, to any who would turn to him, so he could become new, right? So there wouldn't be condemnation, there'd be justification, and there'd be life. But if you don't think that Genesis 1 through 12 represents reality, this whole passage breaks down. And that analogy between Adam and Jesus is very difficult to reconcile. All right, enough with the spiritual implications. I want to spend the rest of my time. There's way more than that. I just glossed the surface. There's so much more that could be said. I want to spend the rest of my time just presenting a few arguments against Darwinism. Now, we do not have time for an exhaustive list. That would be many hours. But I do want to hit a few highlights. And the way I decided to do this was I rented a college biology textbook off of Amazon, which actually is ridiculously cheap to rent for the summer. It's like $20. And I went through and I read the four chapters on evolution. They had four. They're long. And then I went and I watched some Khan Academy videos, which is what you do, right? When you don't understand something, you're like, oh, let's look it up on Khan Academy. Anyway, you students know. And then I went and read the National Academy of Sciences arguments for evolution versus creation. And I put together a spreadsheet, which I can share with you if you'd like. You know, in honor of Josh, I had a spreadsheet. But these are like the top 11. There are probably like 16 or 17 that get cited. These were the ones that appeared most commonly. And so first was natural selection to descent. We're going to talk about that. This gets into how do you define evolution. And what you'll find is people define evolution in a variety of different ways. When I'm speaking of evolution, I'm speaking of the monkeys to man, rats to people, slime to, you know, complex creatures. Some people define evolution as change over time. That's not evolution. That's natural selection. We'll talk about that. That is a process that does occur, but that's not evolution. Evolution and natural selection are two different things. The fossil record we're going to talk about. Homologous features we're not going to talk about. That just means the bones in my arm look like the bones in a bat arm look like the bones in a horse's arm. We actually are going to talk a little bit about that. Biodiversity, we'll just barely touch on. Embryogenesis we'll hit. Molecular homology is just homology, like it looks the same, is now like the genes are like the same. Same thing with genetic code. We're not going to talk about it. I would love to talk about antibiotic resistance. I do like hour-long lectures on antibiotic resistance. Short version is, it's just natural selection, okay? Nothing new gets created. It's an argument for natural selection, not for evolution. The eye, I could not believe people put the eye as an argument for evolution. It is mind-boggling. People who put that don't actually know how the eye works, okay? I'm not joking. They do not understand the complexity of the eye. The human evolutionary record, we're going to touch on briefly. Vestigial structures, really interesting topic to look into. This is not a good argument, I think, for evolution. Most of the vestigial structures actually end up, over time, have turned out to be useful structures. Anyway, I'm not going to talk more. Convergent evolution. This is another crazy idea that people think supports evolution. This is the idea that birds can fly, bats can fly, and fish can fly. Okay? Now they all can fly, right? But evolution would not say that they all came from the same flying progenitor. They would say that flight evolved in birds, flight evolved in bats, flight evolved in fish, which to me makes evolution like three times harder, right? Super complex, because those are not easy things to do. You may not know it, but flight is a highly engineered process that's super complicated and has tons of specialized structures, okay? All right, I'm sorry, I'm going to get fired up when I talk about this. And then the tree of life. We're not going to talk about the tree of life. The tree of life is fake news. There's like this now, this like bush of life that looks like this. Anyway, we don't have time for that, sorry. But I do have, and I'm happy to share with anybody, arguments against or sort of contradictions or discussions of these topics. All these are from Creation Ministries International. If you have a question, that website is fabulous. It is, I think, one of the best resources you could ever find to discuss virtually every topic on evolution. I just typed in each one of these topics, and they came up with 5 or 10 articles on them. If you want a single book, I would get the book Refuting Evolution. Short, easy to read, written by a PhD scientist, really good. He has a second volume that's much thicker. Both fabulous books if you're interested to get started. All right, so this is the first thing. Who's seen this picture before? Right. These are Haeckel's embryos. This is a famous picture in evolution, okay? What the idea of this picture is, this guy Ernst Haeckel was a German biologist, drew these embryos. And the idea is, as you go through embryogenesis, you recapitulate evolution. Where they came up with that idea, I'm not sure, but that was their idea. You start off as like this little fishy-like thing with gills and things like that, and then you get a little more differentiated, and then you end up looking like, you know, whatever you're going to be. And so he drew these embryos, and you'd look at them and say, boy, yeah, they do look very similar at the top there, and they're a little different, okay. Well, they look pretty similar unless you looked at reality, okay? So, yeah, well, but he looked at the actual embryos, we think. But so what actually happened was even back in his time, people said, boy, Ernst, you know, your embryos, they don't look quite like the embryos that we saw, and you're kind of picking and choosing where they are in embryogenesis. And despite that, this has been in biology textbooks for over 100 years. Although what I'll tell you is this is reality, okay? Here's Haeckel's drawings. Here's reality. They don't really look that much alike, do they? I mean, that's, I mean, maybe a little similar. Maybe you got turtles pretty close, but they're not the same, right? And this has been known for 70, 80 years. This is not new knowledge. But I'll tell you, in Campbell's biology, they at least did not have this picture. They did have a picture for an embryo and the same argument. Despite this being debunked science and many evolutionists saying, boy, we really probably shouldn't use this argument because it really doesn't, it's not really congruent with reality, okay? And that's what I want to believe, things that are congruent with reality. I don't want people drawing me pictures that are fake and trying to convince me of stuff, okay? All right. Even if they did look alike, though, okay? And this is the argument of homology. Even if they did look alike, does that prove that they are descended from a common ancestor? Right. So the question is it common descent or common designer? So, you guys have probably all seen these, right? We have the AT-AT walker from the best Star Wars movie ever, Empire Strikes Back, right? It's well adapted to its environment, right? It's open spaces. It's not super mobile, but that's okay. All it has to do is destroy the shield generator. But then you move to the forest moon of Endor, right? It's kind of tighter spaces, big trees. You got to have a bipedal form that somehow evolved. It's more mobile, the AT-ST, right? And so you got to move around. And then, you know, you get to the, what, Last Jedi, and you have this, you know, almost bipedal walker here. It's amazing. He's got, like, some hands here. You can maybe climb up a cliff. You know, you say, boy, I see evolution. This is amazing. The walkers are evolving. Or they were all designed by the same guy, right? And so this is where we talk about the glasses you put on. You can say, boy, that, you know, those bones look all the same. They must have evolved. Or maybe they were all designed by the same God who said, boy, that's a really good structure. And I'll just tweak it here and tweak it there and tweak it here and tweak it there. And this is the same argument against molecular homology, okay? So a little bit of a silly example, but hopefully it makes the point. All right, next I want to talk a little bit about natural selection. So I'll just tell you, Darwinism is not the theory that Darwin came up with anymore. It's now called neo-Darwinism or the neo-Darwinian synthesis because he didn't know anything about cells, like it was just a bag of jelly. He didn't know anything about genetics. And so they had to marry, you know, more modern genetics with Darwin's theory. And so now it's all mutations that are carried on. And this is how the National Academy of Science says it. They say genetic mutations arise by chance in your DNA. So things go wrong in your DNA. These may or may not equip organisms with a better mean for surviving in this environment, right? The change is good or it's bad. If it's good, it helps me better adapt. I can use nutrients better, run faster, etc. The organisms carrying that gene are more likely to survive and reproduce than those without it. Over time, their descendants tend to increase, changing the average characteristics of the population. And so that would be the modern view of natural selection. And they would say that process ad infinitum turns monkey, you know, turns slime into people, right? That's what they would say. We went from some sort of slime that reproduce itself to you guys sitting there right now, okay? That is the neo-Darwinian through this process and this process only, okay? So, now one thing you need to know is natural selection does occur, okay? It does occur, and I want to talk about dogs, not just because they're cute, but because dogs are a great example of natural selection. And as Christians, we don't need to reject natural selection because I think that natural selection was how God developed all the many different kinds of animals, right? If you remember, Noah took, what, two of every kind of animal, okay? And so he took two dog kinds. Now, these are all dogs, right? You look at me like, these are dogs. Now, they're very different in size, head shape, ears, tails, fur. If I were to show you wolves, foxes, dingoes, hyenas, you'd all say, yeah, those are dogs, okay? The dogs can interbreed even. That's how we can know they're all from the same kind. And so natural selection worked on dogs to help them survive in the environment and brought out the genetic diversity that was already present. Natural selection didn't create dogs. It helped to diversify dogs. So let me give you a more practical example, okay? So it's Chihuahua, right? It's like 8 pounds maybe. Very evil dog. Sorry if you have Chihuahuas. We had a neighbor Chihuahua that was very evil. He would try to bite me through the fence. They don't have a lot of fur, right? They don't have much fur. They're just like little tiny guys. They like shiver all the time. Then you have a husky, right? Big dog, lots of thick fur, doesn't get bothered by the cold. So how do we get from some dog to something like that and something like that? Well, this is just a brief example for fur length. So we start with two dogs, both of which have two genes for fur, one for long and one for short. That's what L and S stand for, a long gene and a short gene. So you have a medium fur, right? Long and short gives you medium. This is a little artificial, but this is generally what goes on. And so those dogs interbreed, and you get a mix of those genes. And some of them come out with just short, two short genes. Some of them come out with both, and some of them come out with just long. Now, if you're living in the Antarctic, which dog is going to survive? Is your the long-haired one, right? Is your little short chihuahua, short-haired dog? Probably not going to survive. And so the forces of natural selection will work on the dogs to select for the long-furred dogs. They're going to survive more preferentially. Okay? That's normal. That's good science. That's natural selection. That's okay. That's not dogs turning into monkeys. Okay? Now, what happens over time is eventually all you're left with is these long-haired dogs. Now, let me ask you a question, and this is actually a really important thing to understand about natural selection. Do these long-haired dogs have more genetic information or less than when they started? Right. They only have long hair genes. And so what if it gets warm where they live? Are they going to be able to adapt? No, they're probably going to get really hot and sweaty and die, okay? Because they've lost those genes. And so it's really important. This turns out to be the key way natural selection works. It doesn't work by creating information. Natural selection works by removing information, right? In that dog example, we got rid of the short hair because it wasn't needed in the cold. But now our dog can't adapt as well. And that's what we see over and over in natural selection. Natural selection does not create information. It removes information from the population. And what I'll tell you, and I could talk about this for a whole nother talk, there are no current processes for creating new functional genetic information. There are no processes for doing that. There's a lot of theories, a lot of hand waving, a lot of we see this doing that, but there's not any processes for doing that. Let me give you one more example. It's a polar bear. Is a polar bear well adapted to its environment? Yeah, right? It lives in the Arctic, so white is good. That's good to be white in the Arctic. It's got a lot of fur, more fur than other polar bears. And another way it's well adapted, it can survive on eating just blubber, okay? If you remember, most bears are omnivores, right? They eat berries and honey and fish and plants, and they eat a wide variety of things. Polar bears don't. They pretty much just eat blubber. It's a fascinating paper published in BMC Genomics where they compared the genetic makeup of polar bears with brown bears. And what they found is that in brown bears, they had a variety of different genes in a bunch of different places. In polar bears, a bunch of those genes were fixed. They only had one copy, okay? So polar bears, while they're well adapted to their environment, do not have the genetic diversity of a brown bear. And so if their environment changes, they're going to die. Because they're not evolving to become a more advanced bear, they're actually devolving. They're losing genetic information. That's how they got good at blubber. They lost some metabolic genes. That's how they got all that thick fur. They lost the shorter fur genes. And in those areas, they're fixed. They cannot adapt any longer. And this is what goes on in natural selection. What we see over and over and over again is the loss of genetic information. Natural selection does not move us to a higher genetic plane. We lose information. We devolve. But God designed, I think, natural selection and all this genetic diversity into us, into animals, so that we can have all this diversity, so that animals could fill the earth, right? They went out and filled the earth. How do they fill it unless God has built that amazing diversity into them? All right, I just want to finish up with a couple minutes on human fossil record, particularly on fossil record. So this is what the National Academy of Sciences says. Today, many of the gaps, and I'll just tell you, Darwin, when he wrote his theory, said, we don't really have the fossils to support what I wrote, but I'm confident that we will find it. Don't worry, it just hasn't been found yet. And so the National Academy of Science would say, we have found it. The record has been filled. Hundreds of thousands of fossil organisms found in well-dated rock sequences represent succession of forms through time and manifest many evolutionary transitions, right? The transition from monkey to man, the transition from, I don't know, dog to whatever, all those transitions. We've got them all. Now, I would not want to call them disingenuous, but they're a little overreaching on their fossil evidence. They do have hundreds of thousands of fossils, but of transitionary forms, they have a small number, dozens, and people don't really agree that they're transitionary forms. People are arguing about them constantly. If you look at the fossil record, what you'll find is body shapes just appear all of a sudden. Oh, there's a dog. Oh, there's a crab. Just suddenly appears. There's no, like, between a sea cucumber and a crab. There's no in between that. There's just sea cucumber and crab. They appear in the fossil record. All 32 mammal orders just appear. They don't, there's no like transition into them. They're just, oh, yep, there it is. And if you were to look, you'd say, you know, bats. Bats have been around supposedly for 250, 300 million years. If you looked at a bat fossil from last year, from 1,000 years ago, and from 200 millions of years ago, you'd say, well, that's the bat, and the bat, and the bat. That one's a little bigger. That one's a little smaller. That one's got a little different claws. But it's a bat. Same thing with horses. Say horse, 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 horse. Just different shapes and sizes, but they're all horses. Okay? There's no like in between to the horse. And even the evolutionists have to be a little honest about this. This is Stephen Jay Gould. He's a famous promoter of evolution. The absence of fossil evidence for intermediary stages between major transition to organic design, indeed our inability even to imagine to construct functional immediates has been a persistent nagging problem. So not only do we not have them, we have a hard time like imagining what they might be. We can't even make them up because it's really hard. Okay? So that's what the evolutionists say. I just want to really briefly touch on human evolution, right? Who's seen this picture or a version of this picture, right? This is, so people talk about icons, right? Religious icons. We have pictures of Jesus. This is an evolutionary icon. We need to genuflect before this icon, right? This is the great teachings of evolution. And it's a really powerful picture, right? It's got skulls. It's got pictures. We've got monkeys up to man. It communicates the pictures. Monkeys evolved into man, right? Oh, I see it. I'm sold. Unfortunately, the human fossil record is not so clear, right? This is not actually how it goes. It's been filled with frauds. This is a famous one, Piltdown Man. He was supposed to be the missing link found in England. For 40 years, they believed in him until they found out he was a fake. Chimp skull, orangutan, jawbone, and... human skull, orangutan, jawbone, and chimp teeth. I thought the paleontologists were supposed to know about this stuff. But one other thing you should also know about human fossils is nobody gets to see them or touch them. Okay? They're super rare. The people who have them behind, like, they're in vaults, and they're the only ones who get to look at them. Because they don't want anybody else to examine them, to discover things, to publish things about them. And so human fossils are exceedingly rare and not shared. Okay? So another example, closer to my home. This is Nebraska Man, supposed to be the first ape man in North America. They found these teeth up in northwestern Nebraska in the early 1900s, influenced some of the people in the Scopes trial. Turns out these were pig teeth. Whoops. This is an example of a human evolutionary. This is a reality of human fossils. Just because people draw them this way doesn't mean this is actually what they were. Some of these early ones, like Australopithecus, this is Lucy. These are apes. These are monkeys or just different kinds of monkeys. People like the Homo erectus, Homo neanderthalus, these are just humans, different shapes and sizes of humans. Actually, you may not know this, but up to 10% of your DNA may be Neanderthal DNA. Okay, they found that Neanderthal DNA is part of human DNA, which means that Neanderthals are humans, right? They're just a different shape and size of humans, okay? And so this is an example of the human evolutionary tree. It's a bunch of question marks. We got nothing back there. But it's gotten so bad, and this is a paper that just came out in May, and it's in Science, which is one of the top two most prestigious journals in science. Top two. If you get a paper in Science, you like put that up on your wall. Okay, this is what they say. This is their review of all the human fossil evidence. They say after 150 years of continuous discoveries, essential information about human origins remains elusive. Even worse, relatively complete ape fossils, undisputably assigned to early members of gorilla and chimpanzee lineages, remain to be found. The human fossil record, not so great. We don't even have an ape record. That's what they're saying. And then when they look at, like, the functionality, and this is what they're plotting, like quadrupedalism, bipedalism, you know, we should go from, like, walking on all fours to, like, sometimes on two to bipedal. They don't see it in the apes. Even functionally, it's not there. And in this, I can't believe that they said this. I just can't believe they said this, what they said. Humans are storytellers. Theories of human evolution often resemble anthropogenic narratives that borrow the structure of a hero's journey to explain essential aspects such as the origin of erect posture, the freeing of the hands, and brain enlargement. Intriguingly, such narratives have not drastically changed since Darwin. What does that mean? That means we've been telling stories about how these happen, and they're just stories, and they're the same stories we've been telling from Darwin, because we don't have data to support any of it. We must be aware of confirmation biases and ad hoc interpretation by researchers aiming to confer their new fossils a starring role within a pre-existing narrative. Evolutionary scenarios are appealing because they provide plausible explanations based on current knowledge, but unless grounded in testable hypotheses, they are no more than just so stories. Just so stories are stories that Rudyard Kipling wrote about how the giraffe got his long neck, how the elephant got his trunk, and they're just made up stories. The evolutionists are even admitting these stories, we just make them up and we don't have the data. This isn't science. This is what the American National History Museum said about this paper. You may recognize this. This was the museum from Night at the Museum. It's a famous New York American History Museum, Natural History Museum. Most human origin stories are not compatible with known fossils. I thought it was good evidence for evolution. There is no scientific consensus on the evolutionary role played by these fossil apes. I thought evolution was a settled idea. Overall, the researchers found that most stories of human origins are not compatible with the fossils we have today. I can't believe they published this. They're admitting that it's wrong, that they don't have the data, because they don't. And so again, back to the zombie. I really do think genetics has crushed, and this just, I'm just telling my opinion. There'll be, I'm sure many people would argue, but I think genetics, what we know about how genetics work, the complexity, evolution can't be explained. Now, I'll tell you, non-Christian scientists are starting to say this. They're starting to propose new ideas, things like crystals supporting evolution and self-organizing clays and galactic seeding by comets and space aliens, which sort of just moves the idea to another place. These are what non-Christian materialistic philosophers are starting to write, that evolution isn't working. We can't make it work within what we find. So you might say, well, boy, if science contradicts it, why do people continue to believe it? Why do they believe in, like, space aliens instead? Seems really silly. And this is where I think we go back. Oh, where'd my verses go? I lost my verses. Anyway, this is where we go back to Romans 1. We'll not leave the zombie up. So we read this verse earlier. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what's been made, so the people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave him thanks, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. People do not see the reality because they have chosen to accept, there it is, a materialistic, they come to it with a materialistic approach, a scientism approach. And so when the reality doesn't fit that, they don't say, well, I have to change. Well, some of them might. Some of them actually have, but not many. But why don't they change? Because God makes your thinking foolish. If you refuse to acknowledge him, he is obvious. We talked about that yesterday. If you refuse to acknowledge him, you move into futility and foolishness and empty philosophies. And we're going to talk about some of those later. So hopefully you've been encouraged by this. Hopefully it's been helpful to you. I'll just pray. Lord, we thank you for your creation, Lord. We thank you that you're such an amazing God in what you did. We thank you that what you say is true, God, that we can put our trust in it, that it's reliable, God, that the science backs up what you said, and that's because you created it all. God, we are so thankful for your salvation, God. We're so thankful that you've brought us Jesus, Lord, so we don't have to be foolish or futile in our thinking. God, I pray you just help us to search out, Lord. I pray you help these young men and women to just search out the answers they have questions, talk to people, read, seek more understanding, God. Help them to really be students of this. In Jesus' name, amen. Do we have time?